All right, the meeting's being recorded. Let me edit. Okay, this meeting is being recorded. So I'm Mike Tessel at UChicago grad, University of Chicago. Many of the things that we do, I should say a couple things first. One is I've been working at the university for about 8.5 years in career development for graduate students. Before that, I was a postdoc and a graduate student. I've been at a few different universities in the Chicagoland area, University of Chicago, Northwestern, and UIC, and I'm excited to be at Fermilab for the first time. We do many things for graduate students and postdocs when it comes to career planning. We help them with career planning strategy. We help them with job documents. We help them with professionalization skills, help them learn about the landscape of careers, preparing for all kinds of careers, whether it's in academia, industry, government, or nonprofit work. Because the topic was fairly open-ended, I thought I would talk about my favorite part of what we do, which is where do PhDs go with their PhD? But I'll be happy to answer questions related to any career development topic at the end of this talk. First, I wanted to start with some data because you're all scientists. I figured you like to see some data. So this, you know, to me is fairly interesting. Now, this is 4-year-old data, but I think it kind of gets to one of the points that I wanted to make here, which is, if you look at this, this is the percentage of PhDs that go into academic careers broken down by discipline. So I think for you all here, probably the physical sciences and mathematics and computer sciences, most of you fall into that. And what you'll see is that somewhere between, back in 2018, somewhere between 20% and 30% of PhDs go into academic careers. That means most of people like you end up in a career that's not an academic faculty role. You'll also see a dramatic change, especially in the mathematics and computer science, just in the 10 years leading up to this survey, the largest drop of any discipline from 50% down to 30% going into academic careers. So huge drop that happened there. I have some data from the University of Chicago, where I'm from, but we think this is likely representative of similar institutions across the country. And this is 5 years post-completion of their PhD. Where are these graduate alumni? And what we see is that over 50% of them are in what is referred to here as non-academic roles. And then even with those within academia, about 20% are in faculty roles. Another 20% are still in postdocs after 5 years, and then some are in some type of non-tenure track role within the academy. But, and I put here physics and astrophysics. I hope that would sort of capture an equivalent population to what we have here, and it's fairly similar for astrophysics as well. Okay, so that's what the data say. So you might ask me, what do those 50 to 70% of physics PhDs do after they finish their PhDs or their postdocs? Of course, there are academic postdoc positions they go on to and faculty careers. I'm not going to talk much about those now, but I'm happy to answer questions about that path. Hopefully, you have some support on that path if that's where you're looking to go. National labs, of course, that's where we are. There are postdoc positions and scientist positions. But the big four fields that I see people coming to my office and wanting to know about are these. And I've seen a lot of growth in data science over the last 5+ years with people with physics PhDs going to that field. Of course, different types of industrial research are common for physicists. And consulting careers are also fairly common for me to advise people on. And quantitative finance is another thing that comes up fairly frequently. So that's not an exhaustive list. There are other things, and I'll mention those. So I just want to go through each of those four things and tell you a little bit about what they are, and then we can also take questions about any of them at the end, too. Just show a couple of examples of some of our alumni here throughout this presentation, but basically many of the skills you use in your research have application beyond scientific research. Now it could be data science within a company that does scientific research, or it could be in a company that does something totally different, anything from healthcare to the tech industry. A lot of people come to my office and say, I want to go into data science, but what they really mean is they want to work in the tech industry. And what I guess what I want to help all of you understand is that there is data science in tech, certainly, and some really cutting edge data science there, but there's also data science everywhere. Every company that now realizes that they have a lot of data and don't know what to do with it is trying to hire data scientists. There's a lot of opportunity there. And then kind of within this, there are different types of titles. You'll see sometimes it'll be like machine learning software engineers that are kind of adjacent to the sort of data science roles. Industrial research. This means different things to different people depending on what field you're coming from. It's often the most common thing people tell me, I want to go into industry. I say, what does that mean to you? What does going into industry mean? To a lot of people, this is what it means. Now, to some people, it means they want to go into finance or consulting. But for many people, when they first come to my office and say, I want to go into industry, they mean they want to be a scientist, but they just want to do it for a company and not for a university or a national lab. So for scientific research positions in industry, some of them require postdoc experience or prefer it at least. Others don't. And then the career progression on these, you know, typically a scientist in industry will take on more and more responsibility, often leading teams of scientists as they progress through their career. There are some postdoctoral positions in industry, although I'd say I see it less frequently in physics than I do in the biological sciences, but there are opportunities to do a postdoc in industry that are out there. And then these are just a few of the sectors that I tend to see physicists going to. And from the University of Chicago, it tends to, this quantum computing has been a lot of growth there. So I've seen a lot of people going into research scientist positions there. So see a couple, you know, example here. Semiconductor industry, of course, hires a lot of our physicists and our chemists. And then I think other universities, it might be a little bit more than we see at Chicago, aerospace and energy. We're not, we don't see as many people going into those, but you do see physicists going into that. Consulting is a big one. A lot of people tell me, okay, I like doing research. Now I'm ready to move on and do something else. Management consulting companies really like hiring smart PhDs. And the nice thing about these jobs, people who go into it, is that they'll kind of take you as you are. You don't need to know anything about business. They'll just sort of hire you as a big brain that they can essentially you know, lease to their clients to help solve complicated business problems. So the big strategy firms really like hiring PhDs, McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group, and Bain, particularly from top universities. And then I think what happens is many times people don't stay in these jobs for more than a couple of years. They'll often move on to something else. So let's say you want to do something closely related to science, but on the business side, management consulting is a great way to get some experience in business and then translate that over into industry as someone who knows business but also has scientific training. I also put here, your data science skills could be used in a consulting role. There are consulting, there are data science arms of large consulting companies, and there are boutique consultancies that do data analytics for their clients. Quant finance, I've seen actually a growth in this over the last couple years. These companies, I've talked to the recruiters, they love physicists. There's something about the modeling that's common in physics that translates really well into finance. So I get strong reactions to this type, to this field when I meet with students and postdocs. Some people are all about it and embrace it, and other people say, I will do anything but that. But regardless, I wanted you to know that it's out there. There are hedge funds, there are proprietary trading firms, and investment banks that really like to hire physics PhDs to do quantitative finance roles. But there are many more things that you can do with a physics PhD, and these are just some of the things that I see less frequently. So those things that we talked about so far, I probably work with, you know, on the order of 10 to 30 people a year that are interested in. These are things that come up less frequently, like anywhere from, you know, zero to once a year. I hear about some of these things, but they're out there and they really value your experience. So nonprofit research institutes, there are a few prominent ones. They're highly competitive and selective. And so we've had some physicists go to things like the Flatiron Institute. The Simon Foundation is pretty common. We always get a couple of people applying there every year. Some people want to either work at a startup or eventually start their own company. Government policy, aside from working at a government lab, there are science policy jobs in DC. There's a science policy fellowship that Jeff could tell us about as well. Some people want to work at think tanks. There's a few think tanks that really like physicists. Some of them, one common one that recruits at UChicago is the Institute for Defense Analyses, that you're probably familiar with. The RAND Corporation is a similar organization. IP, you can go into IP law. Science communication, I see this less commonly for physical sciences students, not because it's not an option, but maybe because there are other options. I see this a little more with biological sciences. Teaching, this comes up very infrequently, but there are places that are desperate for people like you who want to educate young people and young scientists. Then, of course, you could work at a university like me and Beth and do administration or research administration, help running the research. Maybe a machine or a core facility is an opportunity for people with physics backgrounds. And then, of course, like scientific industrial products, occasionally to field application scientists or technical sales reps. Very infrequently, I've worked with probably like three or four of those people in 8 years. I wanted to leave you before introducing Beth with just a few career resources, and the slides I'll send you will have some hyperlinks here. A few online resources. I think the APS web career page is really good. They have not only a job board that has both academic and non-academic careers, but a bunch of other resources there for learning about career options and developing skills. Science Careers has My IDP page. That means My Individual Development Plan. Free resource for those who are basically trying to think about what the next steps are. There's a self-assessment tool, and then it can help you discover different career options that might fit your skills and interests. Versatile PhD has a nice kind of breakdown of some of the different careers. Now, this is a subscription that some of your universities may subscribe to, some may not for the premium content, but there's still some free stuff there that's interesting. Speak of scientists, I say this with a lot of caution, they do try to sell you on their services, but there's free stuff on their website that's really useful for career exploration. Many university websites have free stuff that's available to everyone, so University of Chicago grad, anyone could see our resources on the website. And then, of course, if you're not on LinkedIn, no matter what you want to do in your career, please sign up for LinkedIn and take it seriously. It is really, I'm not going to say it's the future. It is the present of the job of the professional world. Here are a few books that we recommend for people thinking about academic careers or other careers. And with that, I want to introduce Beth Powers, or I'll let her introduce herself. Hand off this microphone.
But how about I let you kind of, sure, that would be great for me. Everybody can hear me okay? Okay, great. Thank you. So my name is Beth Powers, and I am the director of fellowships in writing at UChicago grad. I have been there a little bit less time than Mike. I've been there for 3 years, but I have 20 years of 20 plus years of fellowship advising experience. And so I work with graduate students, and my specialty is working with our STEM students. I also work with our social students. And that has been a great joy to me, actually. I spent a lot of my time working with undergrads and not as many science earlier in my career. So I have very much enjoyed, and there are lots of fellowships out there. With postdocs, Mike and I sort of have this agreement. If it looks like a job application, in other words, cover letter and CV, the careers team works with it. If it looks like a fellowship application, give us your personal statement. Tell us about how you got interested in the field. Tell us about your leadership skills. It's probably going to come to me. And I think a lot of times it can be a little tougher for postdoc students to find these services, but Mike's giving you some good resources as well. So we're going to talk about searching and applying. And so first, unfortunately, I'm going to give you the bad news. We're just going to get it out of the way very quickly. Prepare yourself. The fellowship search is generally not fast, easy, or instantly fruitful. And that is because there is no wonderful database out there that you can put all this detailed information in about yourself, and it spits out exactly all the fellowships that are perfect for you and none that are not. For most people, it is a little bit more of a slog, but we're going to give you a little bit more information about it. It tends to be something that just requires a little bit more patience and persistence when doing it. So my recommendation when you are out there searching for fellowships, and I think Mike's was very similar when it comes to careers, try more than one database. I'm going to mention a couple here that I think you might find useful. For instance, if I'm working with students at the University of Chicago and they are interested in looking at fellowships and they are curious about what the university itself might offer, my database is going to be the best database to look at. However, if they're thinking like, I'd really like a fellowship that might take me overseas somewhere, or I'm interested in one of the fellowships in the national labs, there are going to be other places that they are going to want to look. You also need to make sure that you are devoting some time to exploration. For most people, this is not something where you can just sit down in 1 hour and you're done with it. You're going to, I'm not sure I would advise anybody to sit down and do like 4 hours of fellowship exploration at one time. It can start to kind of swim in front of your eyes, and a lot of time, you often have to drill down. You find a fellowship that looks like, this is a really great fit for me, and then you realize somewhere along the line that, oh, you don't meet one eligibility requirement. So you kind of have to go in and find generally a few different fellowships and then drill down a little bit more to figure out, okay, do I fit this fellowship? Is the timing right for me? And then sometimes, is this going to be worth my time to apply? And then as you're doing this, you want to record all of the things that you are doing. I think ideally, you shouldn't have to do fellowship searches very often. You can, because at whatever point you are in your graduate career or in your postdoc, if you keep a calendar and you keep a list, you can say to yourself, okay, you know, I am a second year right now. I am eligible for this thing right now, but then next year I'm going to be eligible for this thing. Put it on your calendar. And then when I'm going into my postdoc career, I'm going to be eligible for that thing. And you can kind of get everything planned out. Unlike the job sphere, where actually there are new things coming in all the time, right? New jobs are being created, new companies are being created. You have to be out there and looking pretty regularly because new things are coming out there. That's not as true of the fellowship world. Most of the fellowships that are out there have been around for a while. There will be some new ones that will come up, but if you find a good database and you check in periodically, you'll probably be able to catch up on those. So here's some information about where you might want to start looking. Is anybody here familiar with the Pivot database? Pivot? Okay. If you are at the University of Chicago, we have a subscription to this. Universities tend to have subscriptions, and a lot of times they don't advertise these to graduate students and postdocs, is what I found. Two of the big databases are Pivot and then Grants Forward, I think it is, Grant Forward. And these are databases that are amazing databases with thousands of fellowships in them for people from around the world. And I really want to emphasize that to those of you who are international students. They are great databases. If you log into the Pivot database, the first thing it's going to ask you is what institution you attend. And if your institution has a subscription, if you check in with me after after this session, I can let you know if your institution has a subscription. If not, you might want to go through your research office. I think a lot of times these databases are viewed as a faculty resource. And unless you have somebody in my role on your campus, students may not be able to, students probably have access to it, but they may, it may not really be promoted to them as an actual resource for them where they can go in and find lots and lots of different fellowships. And so Pivot is a database where you can go in with a keyword and you can get thousands of fellowships. If you put physics in there, you would probably get something like 5,000 hits. And then you go, oops, I don't want to look through 5,000 opportunities. So then you go in and refine your search a little bit. You'd have to limit and indicate that you are, in fact, a graduate student or you are an early career researcher. And then you can also indicate what country you are from. So if you're from the United States, it will take away all the scholarships in there for Australians and for Canadians and people from Latin American countries and all those kinds of things, because they do have a lot of international fellowships on there. And then you might want to fine tune from physics to something a little bit more specific to your field. So databases like physics and Pivot and Grants Forward are very good. Harvard has a wonderful database that is open to the public and that is very good for graduate students. I'd encourage you to use it. One of the, if you're in graduate school, you may be familiar with this. Do we have anybody from Champaign here? Okay, so they actually have a great fellowships database. You'll notice I'm not promoting mine. Part of the reason for this is most of us in the fellowships world don't promote our own very much. We rely on this database. They actually have somebody employed about half time whose job is to keep this database up to date. Very good database for graduate students, probably less so for postdocs. For postdocs, you're going to want to get more into something like Pivot or Grants Forward. But this is a great free database you can look at online, and they explain things in a nice, concise way and give you tell you when the deadlines are and give you a referral to the website. Zintellect is another one run by Oak Ridge, which has a little bit of a mix of jobs and fellowships and I think postdoctoral opportunities that I encourage you to take a look at. And how to use fellowship search sites. So start with streamlined sites like the UIUC Fellowship Finder or our database. Keep a list of fellowships that you find with links and deadline dates. Expand to more comprehensive sites after that to Pivot and Zintellect. I think sometimes if you start with something like Pivot, you're just immediately overwhelmed by those 5,000 physics fellowships. And so sometimes starting with something where you can kind of get your list going, starting with something that's a little more modest can be a good start. But if you like to dive into the deep end, start with something like Pivot or Zintellect. Get creative with keyword searches. Learn to think from the funder's perspective. So this is kind of an interesting thing. Sometimes you have to think about, and then physics this may be a little easier, who cares about your research? Who wants to know about your research? Or who cares about you? And so you have to go in there and think about who would fund the kind of research that I'm doing? Is it a space agency? Is it somebody with an interest in nuclear power? Is it some, what am I looking for? Am I looking for something that would give me the opportunity to do research abroad? You might want to look at things like, Fulbright that would come up. And you can indicate whether you want to have certain countries come up on a search in something like Pivot. But if you start, if you go too broad, you get sort of weighed down with a lot of things that are not necessarily a good fit. So be creative with your keyword searches. Think about, I did mention, so there are things about your research that people might want to fund. There also may be things about you. There are fellowships out there for LGBTQ scientists. There are fellowships out there for people of different ethnic backgrounds. And so there may be things about you that might be fundable that are totally separate from what you study. And so keep that in mind. Set up alerts if possible. That is one of the nice things about Pivot. It will give you alerts when deadlines are coming up for fellowships that you have shown an interest in. And go from the search database to the fellowship website, examine what the funder seeks, and the review criteria to assess your fit. This is something I actually spend a bit of time doing with students, is talking to them about their fit. And undoubtedly, if you do a little bit of searching, there's a lot of information out there about fellowships. And you can often find somebody that went to your institution that won one in a previous year. They might be able to talk to you. Sometimes they'll have data about how competitive it is, and you'll be able to assess whether you're a strong fit or maybe not such a strong fit for a applying for a fellowship. And you can, go ahead and flip through all of these. So there are two parts to fellowships from my perspective. the searching for one side and then the applying for one side. So I'm going to talk just a little bit about applying for fellowships. You want to start with a solicitation. Did anybody in here apply for the NSF Graduate Research Fellowship? Remember that big, long, like 18-page document of government language where really there were probably only about three paragraphs that were really relevant to you? You want to go through and figure out what those three paragraphs are. And actually, in that giant NSF 15 or 18-page document, they actually have the review criteria right there in front of you. They tell you what they're looking for. They're pretty public about what they're looking for. And a lot of granting agencies will be very public. So what do they fund? Do you meet their eligibility requirements? You don't necessarily have to meet all of them, but you might have to. You're going to have to sometimes read carefully to figure that out. Are the review criteria available? In many cases, they are. Can you find past winners to talk with? It has surprised me how many people who have won fellowships in the past are so willing to help other people apply for fellowships. I am working with a student right now who's applying for something called the Schmidt Science Fellowship. Anybody familiar with Schmidt? If you're not, look up Schmidt Science Fellows. It is a $100,000 postdoc. It will fund people. You can apply as a graduate student or you can apply during your early postdoc years. It's a really great opportunity. And this student randomly reached out to somebody who had won, who was profiled on the website, and said, "Hey, I'm in your field. This is a postdoc that's interested in people who want to make a pivot in their postdoc years and their research. And could I talk to you?" And he has had two responses of, "Yeah, sure, happy to talk to you." So don't be shy about reaching out to people who are past winners. Figure out when the deadlines are. Sometimes that dictates if you have enough time to apply. Plan your application process. It's a very important part of what you are doing, especially when you're looking at when the deadline is. What does the application require? I tend to divide it into two things. What are the things that you have control over? So that is usually all of the essays and things that you need to write. And then there are the things that other people have control over. Letters of recommendation, your transcript, things like that. Make sure you start with those things early enough that you don't find yourself saying, "Oh gosh, I'm only giving my recommender 2 weeks' notice." You want to make sure you start with the things that you can't control, I'd say, first, to make sure that those are all lined up, and then focus on what you can control. When will you have time to think, write, do outreach, and compile the needed materials? You see, I've included the word think in there. This is the first time I've done that because I've realized that for a lot of people, we tend to downplay the amount of thinking time that goes into something, the time when we're not actually sitting there at the keyboard typing anything. We're reading something and we're learning and we're refining what it is what we want, and we've given it to somebody else and they've given it back with some suggestions. And when somebody gives you feedback, you don't just immediately start making the changes, right? You have to read it over, and then maybe you disagree with something they said, and then you have to think about, wait a minute, is their advice good, or should I change, or should I stick to what I've got? And maybe you need another conversation to do that, or maybe you just need some time to think it over. So make sure you're factoring in enough time that you have time to do those kinds of things. Begin your writing, update your CV. Mike's website has amazing advice and samples of CVs that I think are open to everyone, right? And so actually we use that site for our students who are applying as well. Get other people involved. If you're one of those shy people who doesn't like to share their writing and things with other people, you're going to have to change to be successful with the fellowship. You need to get out there and say, "Hi, talk to your recommenders, talk to other people and say, would you be willing to read my materials?" If you get feedback that says, "This stinks," isn't that great? You got it before you had the chance to submit it. I mean, it's really, you want that feedback early because you want somebody to tell you that you need to change some things so that it can be successful. But also, I think that fellowships, applying for fellowships can also give you a really good sense of yourself. Every now and then, a student will come to me and they'll say, "You know, I gave this to a professor and the professor said, I need to change this thing, but I really don't want to change this. And this is why." And they explain it and we talk about it. And sometimes they realize that maybe the particular professor had a certain bias and it really isn't necessary to change it, or the student gets a chance to say why they don't want to change it, and then as we talk about it, they might realize they do want to change some things. And so I think it tends to make people feel a lot more confident about their own writing and putting information out there in the world for others to evaluate. And yeah, definitely find people to give you feedback. Next slide. Mike mentioned that we're going to be sharing this PowerPoint with you, so you'll have a chance to look at this. Every application is different, but in general, almost all STEM applications are going to require you to put together a research proposal. I think most of you are probably familiar with how to put together a research proposal. One probably landed you here, and so I won't go into a lot of detail about it, but I will say there's a certain amount. When I work with students in STEM, I think a lot of them come to a research proposal with the writing experience of having contributed maybe to an article in the lab or writing reports and that sort of thing. And there's a lot of what I would say is narrative reporting. This is what happened. This is what we are going to do. This is the role that I carried out, which is great because all that information is needed. But you want to remember that your research proposal is actually a persuasive document. You are telling them why you are the right person to carry this out, why the message, but why the questions you're asking and the research methods that you have chosen are the right methods. So you're actually persuading your readers that you're the person and this project is important, this is significant, it's going to make a contribution to your field, it might make a contribution that goes beyond your field. And so that is something to keep in mind. Another thing I will say to keep in mind, and this is especially true if they give you more than 2 pages to write this, is your job is basically 2 things, to make it clear for the reader what you're doing and why you're the best person to do it, what you want to do and why you're the best person. And the other thing is to make it easy for them. Imagine yourself, you're a faculty member or you're somebody who works here and you come home at the end of a hard day in the lab and you have 40 of these things to read before you go to bed. How, you know, you're kind of reading through things, you're looking for keywords, you're looking for ideas, you're looking for something to grab you. And so part of your job is to make it easy for the reader by doing things like using bold and underlining some things, not excessively. Writing in a way that sort of captures your key points in ways that are really easily visible, organizing the material, using numbers, whatever it is you want to do, but using finding ways to make it a lot easier for your reader to read through your application. Questions?
Great, wonderful talk. Are there any questions online? If not, you can go to the room.
So I have heard this before as well, that most of the physics PhDs or postdocs, they can end up having quantitative finance field. But I'm really not sure how PhDs or postdocs, they fit into this quantitative finance. Because if we talk about other fields like data analysis, or as you mentioned, in insurance or in hospitals, so where we have a lot of data to analyze and so one can go to data analyst field, but how someone can develop their career in finance?
Great. So yeah, so the question is about like why and how do physicists fit so well into quant finance. What I've been told by recruiters is that it's the type of modeling that's common in physics that is quite similar to the modeling that they build. So in other words, let's say, you know, they're building a trading algorithm that takes in all kinds of inputs from the financial markets and then sort of has to automate decisions as to essentially, you know, buy or sell of certain assets, stocks, let's say. It turns out that, you know, that requires a lot of complex modeling and coding. That, and I don't do this stuff, so I can't tell you exactly how it works, but recruiters tell me they really like physicists. It's a field that tends to hire, and there's some firms differ a little bit. There's some firms that like pure math backgrounds, so people that, you know, do some, you know, complex differential equation type stuff. There's some firms that prefer people with stats backgrounds doing more, you know, advanced statistical methods. Other firms that are hire computer scientists, some that hire economists, but essentially the firm will have the people that know the business stuff. What they need is with people with advanced modeling skills, and physicists and astrophysicists tend to do really well in that field. So that's about as much as I can say on it. What usually happens when students come to me, many times they're sort of applying to both quant finance and data science when they come to my office. Sometimes they're more focused on quant. The compensation tends to be higher in quant than it is for data science, so some students care more about that. But many times they're applying to both and interviewing for both at the same time.
Thank you.
Other questions in the room? Okay.
So before I pose my question, a little bit of an anecdote. So about 10 years ago, I was like at a job fair at my university, and like me and a couple of colleagues of mine, we were going around talking to like companies. It was like Google was there, I think Procter & Gamble was there, I don't know, like countless of companies. And they went around and like asked each one of them like, hey, what jobs do you have for physicists? And we only got two different types of answers. The first answer was none. And the second type of answer was them trying to dodge the question, like, well, I don't know, because like physicists are intelligent, but they can't use people like doing physics. They can use people doing electronics, computing, data analysis, blah, blah, all the stuff that comes with physics, but you might have to train them on something. Here's the question. How many, like, what jobs are there actually? Like, what trajectories for like going into a job are there where you actually still keep doing physics? Like, what would you recommend for that?
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for the anecdote. What university were you from?
Oh, that was Munich. It was in Germany.
Yeah, so oftentimes career fairs, the people that are sent there are sent to recruit sort of whole classes of people. So, you know, it works really well at the undergrad level, even at like the MBA level, where MBAs where they're getting kind of a uniform degree. When it comes to hiring advanced degree scientists, companies don't as often have recruiters going to fairs to recruit whole classes of people. They're hiring a handful of people every year for these really, you know, degrees that require, for these positions that require super advanced specialized degrees. I would put it back to the industry research category from presentations, probably the closest to the one where you may have a title that is physics. I think one of the people I showed there did have a title of as a physicist, and she is working in a company that's working in the semiconductor. So there, they actually do need people to be physicists within the company. So.
Can you pass on the mic?
No, I just my impression as very much an outsider is that if you had said 5 years ago, I think I would have thought something different. But you mentioned 10 years ago, and I know that based on what I see at the University of Chicago, data training in data science has just started to infuse so many of our degrees for master's students and others in the social sciences, and so that I think there's just a much greater demand. And you also asked about how to use your physics, and this I don't know. I know my son works for an imaging company, and he works on the side, and he works with physicists. He said he's actually the only person who's not a physicist on his team, and they're working on creating imaging machines for hospitals, MRIs, CTs, that kind of thing, and trying to create the best imaging out there and market it to hospitals. And so, you know, I don't know if that's sort of the realm that you're looking at, but I mean, they hire them. Fluke Biomedical. Well, okay.
Any questions? I'll go to this one first.
Hey, thank you both for the presentations. So my question is about whether you have any data or just general sense for how many physics PhD students or graduates that go into non-physics fields for their careers, how many of them go through formal extra training either before or during the application process? And I have a follow-up question for that. specifically for like data science or computational careers, how does one gauge what type of training will be good? For example, like I've looked at a few like data science boot camps, and sometimes I look over the list of things covered. I'm like, well, I've done all of that for particle physics, but I don't have a certificate for that to show an employer. So,
yeah, so that's a great question. The idea of how many need to gain additional training. I'd say many do not gain any additional training. I see them, and when they don't, and if you're looking at data science, it's often because their research kind of lends itself really well to be translated into data science. They're already doing machine learning for their research, so you know it's so companies can take a look at that, even you know perhaps even access their GitHub or whatever and look at their code and see, oh yeah, this kind of data science or data analysis is similar enough to what we do that we don't need you to get any additional training. Now, the more sometimes if I have worked with students and postdocs for whom their research is very specific and the way they use their data analysis skills is so specific that they have over like the year or so before they apply, taken on some side projects. And you can do this independently. Some of them might download an open source data set and just analyze it and put it up on a personal website so that an employer can see it. Some might participate in Kaggle competitions. Kaggle's website, that's like a hub for data science. That has companies post competitions, anyone can do them, and then you can be able to speak to using your skills in a more applied way beyond your research. Boot camps, I'm very reluctant to recommend that any PhD goes out and pays for a boot camp. I don't think you need it. There are enough places that will hire you as a data scientist, train you as needed, and trust that you have the sort of critical thinking skills that they need. And that you could pick up, you know, whatever additional coding you need to pick up pretty easily. There are a couple of these fellowships, they call them fellowships, they're for data science that I've had some people have success with, like Insight Data Science or the Data Incubator, competitive application-based programs that are specifically for PhDs transitioning into data science. I think those are okay, as long as you're not paying, or at least not paying up front. Some of them have salary share models where you like promise them 3% of your first year salary or something like that, which is, you know, kind of mixed feelings on that, but at least you know what you're getting into with that and you're not paying $12,000 up front, like, or $15,000 up front, like some of these coding boot camps charge. I really feel uncomfortable that recommending anything like that for a PhD.
I was just curious, in your experience, have you ever met anyone who goes to industry and then comes back to academics? It seems like an unspoken rule that just doesn't happen.
So, yeah, the question is, do people who go to industry ever come back to academia? There are a few examples out there. You'll meet some faculty members. You've probably met some. I know a couple at our university who did work in industry for a little while, some of them before their PhD, some of them maybe between their PhD and postdoc. It's rare, and I think part of the reason why it's rare, and when we bring back alumni who go into these careers, typically they're quite satisfied with their decision to go into those careers. But there are some people, I've heard an occasional story about it, but they tend to not be channeled through our office to go to that, so maybe I don't have full visibility on just how common it is, but I feel comfortable saying it's rare.
Okay, thank you.
I guess I would just add a comment to that. It also, I think, depends on which field are we talking about. If it's computer science, it's a lot more common.
Computer science, business, I know they do it. Good point.
Okay, there are more questions? So I've been starting to look at jobs a lot of places and data science specifically, and I'm having issues trying to figure out as about to be graduating with a PhD, where do I land on like the job applications that have like junior, mid, and senior level things, because it's often not very clear what they mean by those different levels. And I'm also already having to translate like academia experience from business experience. And it's, do you have any advice on trying to figure out, like, I don't want to sell myself short, but I also don't want to apply for just the higher level positions when I really would be a better fit for the lower ones, et cetera.
Yeah, it's a real challenge what you're pointing out. Like, how do I know what level of job to apply for? I would say for all of you, assuming everyone here is either a PhD student or a postdoc, I would look for a job that's certainly one where advanced degree is preferred. So if the job description says like bachelor's degree preferred, I'd say that's probably not the right job level for you. Not that you might not get hired into it, you probably won't be satisfied with the level of intellectual rigor that the job requires or expects from you. And that's all of you individually, but I've worked with enough PhD students over the years to say that PhD preferred or PhD required is usually really good to see. Something that says master's or like master's degree plus 5 years experience or something like that, I think that could be a reasonable level. So I wouldn't judge it based on like whether it's a senior data scientist one or two or three, like that means nothing compared between.
Okay, we have more questions. Hi, yeah, thank you for your talks. I think you answered part of my question with the question about like how much additional training you need after getting a PhD, but part of my question was a little bit different. So I think a lot of us here like know and love the analysis software Root, and like we are using that a lot. And I'm like in a later stage of my PhD, so I'm starting to try to orient myself what kind of skills I'll need for jobs. Something I've heard is like, once you get out of academic physics, nobody's going to care about Root anymore. Like, this is a disposable skill. How do we go about marketing these skills that are very specific? And I guess, like, if we don't have time to, like, learn a more concrete skill while we're here and we need that additional training, what do we do about that?
So when I talk to companies about this, sometimes they'll say, like, how important is it to you that – you know, that the person knows C++ versus Python or R or something like that. Usually the answer I get is, if someone can code in one language, we trust that they'll learn the one that we prefer. Usually that's the answer I get. Now, if you happen to use the language that they prefer, you know, does that give you, you know, potential, a little bit of a leg up as a candidate? Maybe. But at least recruiters tell me and the people in the field tell me that they're generally accepting of, oh, yeah, don't worry about this. I went to a trading firm in New York, plus career services people come here, and they use a programming language called OCaml, which I had never heard of. And they said, and somebody asked them, do you care if people know OCaml? They say, well, if somebody knows this, that's really impressive, but we don't think anyone's going to know this. We're fine with whatever, you know, bring R, Python, whatever you bring, and it's fine.
More questions?
I know I walked in late, but I listened to the talk on Zoom, so I did hear everything. Thank you for that. One question I have is, I'm still kind of in like middle of my PhD, but as I think about the job market and going to industry possibly, one thing that kind of worries me is like, I know the structure of academia and like the, you know, like not only the skills, but like how like the people are managed, like how like academia is structured, whereas like an industry or like companies, I don't really know much of that. So maybe my skills, like technical skills, can be transferred in whatever way you're discussing. But have you talked to like people who have moved into those roles? Was it easy for them to just kind of like transition into that company structure? And like, how was that process? Like, is that manageable for people?
Wow, that's a tough question. So the question is, yeah, like what's the transition like from the kind of organizational structure of academia, where essentially it's like, you in a lab, you report to your PI, and that's the entire org chart, right? And then you go into a company where it's going to be very different. I guess, and this is not going to be a satisfactory answer, my impression is that it varies quite a bit from company to company, so, you know, from small company to large company, and then even across company sizes, the management styles will change. Typically, there will be more levels of management and oversight than you have as a researcher, whether a grad student or a postdoc, where it's kind of just, you know, your PI is the ultimate decision maker and you work for them. Usually companies are going to be a lot more complex than that. some companies have what they call flat management, where anyone can go talk to anyone at any time, and then other companies will have more hierarchical, where you report to one person and you don't talk to the person above them. So it can be, that can be a real challenge. And I guess the nice thing about industry is once you get your first industry job, and it seems to be pretty easy to move around. So if you don't like the management style of your first company, once you have, once your LinkedIn says that you've worked at you worked in industry, you're going to get recruiters calling you or sending you messages, inviting you to apply for other jobs. You know, I see this students I work for, I follow them on LinkedIn. It's really nice. By the way, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn or either of us. I see how their careers progress. Some of them change jobs, like it seems like every 6 months or something, which is so weird coming from academia where you're here with these professors who have been there for life. But I guess that's to say that some people can take comfort in that. If you don't like the management style, there's always, you know, there's always the option to move elsewhere where the management style is likely different. But that's also some uncertainty that's a little uncomfortable for some of us who like some stability.
I guess on that thread, if I can just kind of quickly follow up, like, is there like a way to learn about some of these things before going in instead of just like meeting it at the job and, you know?
Yeah, so how can you learn about a company culture essentially or organizational culture before you go into a company? Well, first thing I'd say is yes, there's Glassdoor, things like that. Glassdoor is not perfect. There's a lot of kind of false information in there, or I'd say information that's meant, it's like Yelp now, like can you really trust the reviews? But Glassdoor, it's okay to give you some sense. I would say look at the interview process as a way to interview your prospective employer. They're not just interviewing you. You should be figuring out, are these the kind of people I want to work with? Is this the kind of organization that seems to fit my professional and personal values? I mean, those are the kind of things you should be asking because all of you are very well educated, smart people. You don't have to take the first job you're offered, and you should be selective, and you should be interviewing them as much as they're interviewing you.
Thank you.
Question? So this is just going back to the route thing. I had a professor that always gave the advice of when you're trying to market like a specific route, like or skill, like route, don't market the skill, market how you learn the skill. So like for us, like most of us didn't take the class in route. We learned it while doing our research on the fly. So market that you have shown the ability to learn things on the fly like that. And that's that professor said he's had a lot of students had a lot more success doing that than just marketing. I know C++ in route.
Great advice.
And I guess I would also add to that, when I look at the CVs that are not academic CVs, usually you have listed exactly like a sentence, I did this and that, rather than just listing a program that you've been using. So even if they don't know the name of the language, you can say what you exactly did. And that might be more useful for somebody who is like from a completely different area to understand. Okay. We have more questions.
I'm in a position now where I'm trying to decide when to aim for graduating, if I really push maybe in 1 year or maybe I could do a better job in 2 years. What are some advantages and disadvantages to spending longer in a PhD program?
So that does come up fairly often in my advising. Depending on what type of career options you're, and this goes back to some of the previous questions we had about skills development, things like that. Do you feel like right now you have all the skills you need to set up the opportunities that you're looking for? And if not, sometimes having that extra time is also a chance to you know, further develop those skills or maybe even pick up some new ones. Start looking at job descriptions that you're interested in, and you find that there's consistently a gap between your skills and what the job's looking for, then I would think, you know, if I gave myself a year, could I pick up some of these things and have less of a gap? There's also market timing right now. Sometimes it's just, you know, job market's been strong recently. Who knows what it's going to be like next year? Like, they're just unpredictable factors beyond our control there, too. And sometimes, like, if you're looking for a very specific job, one might come up this year and then another one doesn't come up for a while. So, yeah, but mostly I would think about what skills do you need that you don't have, and do you need more time for those? Otherwise, get out there and move on with your career would probably be, if you're ready for the next job, then usually I'd recommend going for it.
Related note, I have a similar kind of question. In your experience, do people that move on to industry mostly do that after the PhD or a postdoc? Because like when I look at the job ads, often they will ask you to have a PhD, but very rarely they ask for a postdoc. Yeah. So people that I talk to often are afraid that those 2 or 3 years will actually be lost time for them, because people in industry will just change 5 companies and have be very, very high by the same time.
Wow, you really hit on a good question. How many postdocs are in the audience? Any postdocs? Okay. So a few postdocs, maybe mostly grad students. It's true that for many of the non-academic jobs, the level you will start at out of grad school will be pretty similar to the level you will start at if you do a postdoc first. So in that sense, some people might think of that as lost years, unless you're picking up skills during that postdoc period that are going to make you more marketable. Unless, or maybe you just personally want to do research for a few more years and that's meaningful to you. I mean, there could be many reasons to do a postdoc. Maybe, but the skill thing is often the best reason. But they realize they have a bit of a skill. The skills, and maybe that lab even has good. Worst type of postdoc is what I do. Don't do a postdoc because you don't know what else to do.
Thank you.
This is also a little bit of a related question, but I'm wondering if you know if there's a correlation between like time between graduating with your PhD and likelihood of getting a job. Does it, do employers, are they discouraged by taking time off?
You're talking about like non-academic employers?
Yes.
Generally.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, for academic jobs, the answer would be different. I feel pretty confident saying they don't really care. Now, if it took you 10 years to do your PhD, you should have a good story behind that, why that happened, because in an interview it might come up, but generally they'll be open to believing your story as long as you have a good one.
So, sorry, the question is more about like between the time of graduating, not how long the PhD took, but is it better to start looking for a job while you're finishing up so you can start a job right away? Does that increase your chances? Or if you take months or even, you know, up to a year off, is that going to start to look for you in your job?
I generally think it's good to start looking before. I tell people, you know, you should be thinking about it 12 months before you graduate, but certainly applying 3 to 6 months before you graduate for most types of jobs. There are some exceptions there. Consulting, I'd say over 12 months. That's a longer cycle. Does it look bad to have a gap on your resume? I think employers are much more understanding about that than they used to be. But, I mean, it puts you in a tough position. Most people would have put them in a tough position if they don't have something lined up. The uncertainty there. And then, of course, you need a story behind that, too. Well, what were you doing during that time? Why did you wait until after you graduated to start looking for a job? So, I think you can overcome that, but you should have a good narrative around it.
More questions in the room?
Any questions about fellowships? Sorry, I feel like I'm standing up here.
Maybe there are questions on Zoom. Please feel free to raise your hands or type in the chat. Olivia can read. No more questions. Something in the chat? Let me check. It's just Olivia saying, please type in.
Well, I say, feel free to reach out to either of us. I even have some cards. I don't know if anyone's seen a business card in a few years, but I have some in my bag. I'll leave some here for you. But it was really a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank the speakers one more time. And Olivia, do you want to close out this session?
Yeah, sure. Thanks again for this wonderful talk today and presentation. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Beth, for coming to the lab today. And for those still on screen, I think we will reconvene on the original Zoom link at about 1:50 for the next session for the new perspectives.
Yeah. Thank you, Olivia. Thank you so much. Yes, go back to the original Zoom, have some lunch in between, and we will see you at 1:50. Thanks, everyone. Bye.